everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they see under the surface.
All right, you bet. And this is episode number 44. And
yes.
Today we're going to talk about H.P. Lovecraft.
Because, are we going to see a lot of traces of the one reality under the surface?
You know, it's possible. But really what we're going to see today is probably the lack of those traces.
Yeah, that's what I've learned.
You bet.
It occurred to me could be a problem.
Yeah, so what we're doing today, we decided to talk about H.P. Lovecraft because, it is October. But he didn't write any novels. So what we did is we just picked four stories that we're just going to kind of talk about today. And they are Dagon and The Statement of Randolph Carter and The Color Out of Space and The Dunwich Horror. Do you have a favorite out of those four?
Oh, The Color Out of Space.
Oh, very cool. Mine's The Dunwich Horror.
And, such a good contender. But
heck yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
but
you
that Color Out of Space.
Yeah. Psychedelic. Very, very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty psychedelic. And that's my style.
That's right. That explains so much. No.
Although also I have a fondness for tentacles, and I believe tentacles are quite prevalent in the Dunwich Horror. So,
right.
I've got a fondness for that,
yes,
too.
Yes, tentacles everywhere.
Well, that's kind of H.P. Lovecraft for you. Tentacles and people who faint.
Right.
Because the shock is so great.
Yep, and then go crazy.
Well, yes.
Yep.
As much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to fit Lovecraft into the American horror scene, Poe died a few years after Lovecraft was born, I believe. I think that they overlap just a touch.
Okay.
I'm not positive about that. I should have looked up the date of Poe's death, but and then comes Lovecraft. And one of the things that I was thinking when I was reading these stories and thinking about this podcast is I would have to say that Lovecraft is more influential than Poe was, and I think he's getting more so all the time. At mm-hmm. least in the circles in which I move. I hardly ever hear anybody talk about Poe, but I'm always hearing people talk about Lovecraft.
And I think Poe tends to, these days, be more influential in terms of maybe detective stories.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't he one of the first ones, or was he the first one?
I thought he was the first one. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it the Murders from the Rue Morgue?
Yeah, the Murders from the Rue Morgue, or Arthur Gordon Pym.
Yeah.
I didn't realize if he's the one that was the first one to come up with that kind of a genre.
I thought he was, mm-hmm. but this is just me, so
you can't
go by that.
You could definitely be right. But Lovecraft... my interest in Lovecraft, a lot of people discovered Lovecraft when they were young, and I discovered mm-hmm. Lovecraft as an adult. And how I came across him is I went to a panel at a science fiction convention here locally in Salt Lake City. The convention I go to almost every year is called Conduit. And
great name.
Yeah. So I was there, and the panel was called The Obligatory H.P. Lovecraft Panel. So, and some of the people that I knew were in there. So I went in there and I listened to an hour of them talking about Lovecraft. And just from what they said, I was hooked.
I can't believe you didn't encounter him before then.
I honestly did not. Most people have these paperbacks that they loved and all this stuff. And, I read, Edgar Allan Poe, and I went mm-hmm. like from Poe to Stephen King. I skipped almost everything. Most of the older fiction that I've read has been as an adult, other than what I had to read for school,
No wonder you're so interested in it. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I get that. But I'm always like, oh, yeah, I read that already.
Yeah,
I'm always interested in going back. There's a lot of authors I didn't know, but
That's so,
Okay.
And well, I'd love to tell this short little story here. One of the guys that was down there at the Salt Lake City Convention. One year brought a introduction to a book written by H.P. Lovecraft in his own hand.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was so cool. What happened is, you know, H.P. Lovecraft often wrote as a ghostwriter for people like mm-hmm. Houdini and things. Now, Houdini wanted to write a book, or wanted a book to be written, about the occult. Houdini was like Penn and Teller in a way. He didn't believe in the occult, and he was frustrated by people who did. So he wanted to write a book or have a book written about the occult that was, you know, putting it down and things. So he commissioned H.P. Lovecraft to do this. And H.P. Lovecraft was incredibly poor. I mean, he was making, yes. you know, $100 a story or whatever.
His whole life. I mean, life.
Yeah, he never made it. In his life, he never made it. You know, the last thing he published right before he died, you know, his crown jewel is probably At the Mountains of Madness. And he published that, you know, very late in his career. So he was just about there, about 46 years old or so. And then he died of cancer. And we'll talk more about his life, because I think his life is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this manuscript is written by hand on letters and things that he received from other people.
Oh, my.
He's writing in margins and around the edges of things.
So poor, he has to use that. Just filling that paper. Thing
completely up with little tiny script.
Wow.
And it was so cool to look at. And it was an introduction to this book. And apparently that book was never finished. It was never, it never got past the introduction, as far as they know. So
yeah, but an introduction for you.
Oh, yeah, it was neat. Yeah, that wasn't the first Lovecraft panel that I'd sat on. That was a couple down the line. They do it every single year at this convention. Okay. Every single year they have a Lovecraft panel. And all it basically is a bunch of people in a room talking about Lovecraft like we're doing right now.
And going, I love this part.
Yeah, I love this and all that.
And what a treat for you to discover him as an adult, though, because I think one of the things I really enjoyed about this is I read his stories, of course, like most people when I was in high school, probably, or junior high. Wow, so cool. But I kind of put them aside after that and didn't really revisit them.
Mm-hmm.
I know those stories. I know all about them. Well, you know, it turns out I've forgotten a lot of stuff. So reading them and the way he uses language and unfolds these tales was really fun.
Yeah. And I find him so different. The writers that are most interesting to me, and probably most interesting to everybody, are the writers that break this new ground. It's like when you read an H.P. Lovecraft story, there's really no doubt who that is.
Yeah.
Anybody who's imitating H.P. Lovecraft, you know what they're doing. They're imitating Lovecraft, right?
Mm-hmm.
But these writers, you know, there's so much noise going on, you know, kind of in the bottom. And then every now and then a writer sticks out of that noise. And this is one of them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He kind of went his own way. And what's unique about him for me is that his horror... You know, Neil Gaiman put it really well in that. Did you listen to that BBC?
I did. It was okay. Great.
there was a BBC audio biography, I guess, sort of a documentary about Lovecraft's life. And Gaiman said something along the lines of, most horror stories, you get on a train and this terrible stuff happens. It's really, really hard. But at the end, everything's okay and you get off the train. And in Lovecraft stories, you just never get off. There's no, the stories end and you're like, what? Wait a minute.
But the train still is going.
The train is still moving. You never get off the train. And from a Catholic perspective, I think why I find Lovecraft so fascinating and disturbing, because I do, these stories stick with me.
They're meant to be disturbing.
They're meant to be disturbing, yeah. And they're not like incredibly gory or anything, although there is a little bit of that. But it's more of a deep, deep disquiet.
Yeah.
And I think that the reason that is from a Catholic perspective, again, you know, we're used to the concept that God cares and God is love and he's out there somewhere, right? And he is much bigger than us. And he gives us hope, right? We have this hope.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lovecraft is hopeless, you know, there is no God going on in Lovecraft's stories, but there are these immense old ones, these elder gods that treat us humans with complete indifference and cruelty.
We're like ants to them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're like ants. You don't look at an elder god and say, hey, can I live through this because this and that, and let me explain this to you, and what about my kids? There's no relation whatsoever. It's not something that you can communicate with, and it's not something that you can create feeling for. So it's just a complete, this universe is so big and you're so tiny and you're so insignificant, and there are things out there that think you're an ant.
And they're usually from some other dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gotten into ours, either someone's called them into ours or they've gotten into ours by accident.
Yeah. Yeah.
And therefore they're completely foreign to anything we can imagine because they're from some place that we could never even get into, kind of space. And that's one thing that I thought was really interesting is, and of course I wrote it down and now I don't have it here, but the way they articulated that in the BBC editorial or documentary that you sent, which was, they were saying his view was, even if there were gods, it was because they were those creatures that got sucked into our world somehow, and their worshipers were people who were like, when they take over the world, I want to be on the right side. You know, right. So they were just willing to be just as twisted as these gods that are so inhuman we can't even describe them.
Exactly.
Which is how he was so good at evoking horror, because that's the thing I love about him, is he uses this huge string of adjectives that basically tells you all this stuff that adds up to exactly nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Amorphous and all this stuff, and you're just going, oh, I don't know what it is, but it sounds awful.
Yeah, so, Eldritch, another word is gibbous. He's got these words that he loves.
Or he'll say other features less pleasant to recall. After he's like in the statement, no, in Dagon, I guess, he's talking about some carvings.
Uh-huh.
And he says, grotesque beyond the imagination of a Poe or a Bulwer. They were beyond, they were damnably human in general outline, despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flabby lips, glassy, bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall. And I'm like, less pleasant than a frog fish man or whatever that was talking about? The size of a whale, by the way. I didn't read that part, but.
Yeah, no question. Now, Dagon was his first sale. So Dagon's the first story we want to talk about. And I'm just going to read the opening. He got more mature in his writing, I think, as time went on.
Definitely.
But here this is, Dagon's a very short story, and it opens like this. I am writing this under an appreciable mental strain, since by tonight I shall be no more. Penniless and at the end of my supply of the drug which alone makes life endurable, I can bear the torture no longer, and shall cast myself from this garret window into the squalid street below. So here's a guy who's doesn't have a lot of hope. and this is really typical of his stories. They're often written by somebody who has been through something and is now going to tell you about it. It's not a typical story where you're following these events. It's being recounted to you, which I think kind of makes it more personal.
Definitely.
Yeah, and he doesn't use a lot of dialogue. I think that's another feature that is worth talking about, because everything that he does, not everything, he uses some dialogue, but most of the time he doesn't use dialogue. He talks like that, or writes like that.
Yeah.
I feel like I should do that as Wayne June. You know, I am writing this under an appreciable, you know. Wayne June, by the way,
so
is
amazing.
Yeah, Wayne June is terrific. There's an audiobook company called Audio Realms, And they have published several volumes of H.P. Lovecraft's work on audio, all read by Wayne June. And highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah. He was, for one thing, he's got one of those very deep, sonorous voices. But when he does other people's voices, he just throws himself into it. He's just a new character, and it's wonderful. Yeah. But the other thing was, I was listening to, what's the last story? Your favorite, whatever that we were reading. Oh, the Dunwich
Horror?
Yeah, the Dunwich Horror. And it's got all these really outlandish words that are describing these old gods, and he's just launching right through them. No big deal. And I'm listening going, what? What? Yeah. Oh, right. These are those awful words that no one can even say because they're spelled so strangely.
Those are crazy names.
He was great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say one thing that, and I'm sorry because I kind of launched us into the story a little bit.
Yeah, that's perfect.
From a Catholic perspective, and this is something I was just thinking of recently, because I just finished reading a book called Angels All Around Us by Anthony DeStefano. And although it's called that, it originally was called The Invisible World, and that's really more an appropriate title. And he was talking a lot in it, especially toward the end, once he's established God's invisible, angels are invisible, there's bad angels, he takes you through the whole thing. And when he was talking about the demons' attitude to us, really, they don't care. I mean, they don't like us, but they don't care about us. We're just a way to get back at God because they're so mad about everything. And when you were talking about these eldritch gods, I suddenly thought, well, and H.P. Lovecraft wouldn't look at it this way, but what a vision of hell. All these eldritch gods, absolutely no hope at all. And these things that you can't even imagine, showing no mercy to the people who can't get away, and there's no solution.
Right.
And I'm not saying that the stories are pictures of hell, but if you needed a way to visualize something so that you wanted to try and do the other thing, the good thing, I don't think this is a bad place to start.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah, that's interesting.
I just, you know, thinking of the colors out of space and that family, I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I just, and since he was an atheist.
Yes.
Of course, he was telling horrific stories to tell horrific stories, but there wasn't going to be hope in these.
Yeah.
So.
That's right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
I broke up your.
It's fine. So Dagon, again, you know, one of the first stories he published, a synopsis, you know, again, it's very short.
Yeah.
So the synopsis is this guy gets stuck out in the ocean and he's walking along the reef and he witnesses something that drives him crazy. Right?
Well, that is quick.
That is quick, yeah. But, you know, what he sees are the description that you read. Some alien or who knows what monstrous thing that he sees, and he's not supposed to see that, which I think is another feature of Lovecraft's writing, is that knowledge, once you know something, it's not always a good thing.
Yeah.
So
there's things we weren't supposed to know.
Right.
Well, and also one of the features of Lovecraft is he likes to have people discover things that are buried.
Mm-hmm.
And they're buried under tombs or in caves or under pyramids. You know,
things that are older than us, older than humanity.
Almost a Tolkienish kind of a concept.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put that.
Which really I old. Didn't think of till now. But yeah, but all, of course, not nice at all.
Yeah.
But the thing I was thinking, too, is in this book, the guy was a sailor. His ship went down and he was in a rowboat. And he was asleep and he woke up and he was on this huge mud flat. And what he finally decided, didn't he, was that there was some odd tide or the moon was really full and it all, where he was sitting actually used to be way at the bottom of the ocean.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So when he's pulling himself across the mud and finding this temple, what he's finding is something of a society or a culture or civilization that was however many fathoms down under.
Yeah. Right.
And that's why he really should have seen it, No one should have seen it.
Yeah, with only a slight churning to mark its rise to the surface, the thing slid into view above the dark waters. That's what I was looking. Yeah.
And loathsome. It darted like a stupendous monster of nightmares to the monolith, about which it flung its gigantic scaly arms, the while it bowed its hideous head and gave vent to certain measured sounds. I think I went mad then. I almost went mad reading it out loud. Really?
Very well done. Very well done.
Yeah. Okay, but I was just, I couldn't stop then. But that's the thing is, all these descriptions and you're going, I have no idea what this looks like, but it sounds awful.
Yeah. And you know, with all that description, he often goes to a spot where he says, it's indescribable. It was indescribably terrifying. And then that's when your mind can fill in the rest. Cause what you've got is tentacles, you've got gross, slimy, and you're like, okay, now I fill in the rest. And it's probably more horrifying than anything he could have written.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gigantic scaly arms, a hideous head, and the certain measured sounds that drove him over the brink are just like, oh, I can't even imagine what those sounded like.
Right, right.
So he really could evoke these wonderful images.
Oh, he sure could.
Which is part of why everybody loves him.
Yeah, and I think so. I think that that's true. And, he leaves so much. Yeah, you wonder, why read him? Well, because of this incredible... You know, why do we read horror in the first place? You know, that's an interesting question in itself.
That pleasurable sense of being scared, but it's safe.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah. So the next story is The Statement of Randolph Carter, which was written only a year after Dagon. And again, The Statement of Randolph Carter is also very, very short. So, you know, as he went along, he started to write longer and longer stuff, but he never got to the novel length. You know, at the Mountains of Madness is the closest thing he came to a full novel, I believe.
Yeah, he had a few longer ones, but that's really the longest. And that's actually, Uvula Audio did a reading of that.
Oh, great.
And it's, you know, it's in, you know, chapter length listening things.
Oh, Uvula Audio. I love them. I listened to... Thomas Merton's The Seven Story Mountain.
Yes.
And it was terrific. Great? It was really something else. Very well read. I agree. Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
So that's a place to get that. And they have another one, The Shadow Out of Time.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have that one too.
All right. I'm going to get that.
Yeah.
Great. So. Great. And we can't help but mention that Will Duquette read The Statement of Randolph Carter for Forgotten Classics.
Yes, he did.
And it's available right now. And he did a wonderful job.
He did.
It was really
fun to listen to.
That's great.
He sent it to me. He called it Chewing the Scenario.
Yeah. Now, The Statement of Randolph Carter. Now, talk about wordy. You know, it's a very short story, but this guy, it opens.
So descriptive.
Yeah. It opens and this guy is like, you know, again, almost in the same state. You know, I'm going crazy. I'm barely holding on to sanity.
Yeah. And I can't tell you anything else.
Go ahead. Yep.
I told you everything I said, you know, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
I told you everything I know.
Right.
If they saw me with a lantern, I can't help it. I don't remember. So
it may have been me. I don't know. But there I was. There I was with my friend. And in this ancient book, which is another feature of Lovecraft's stories, ancient books, we found. Go ahead.
You wonder if this is the first mention of the Necronomicon.
Yeah. It may be, but I'm not positive. But yeah, the Necronomicon is something that appears in a lot of his stories. And I guess it's worth mentioning for those that aren't familiar with Lovecraft is all of his stories kind of fit in this mythos. And then they call it the Cthulhu mythos. So you'll have a story and this Necronomicon will show up like here in The Statement of Randolph Carter. And then in some other story that you'll be reading, like in the Dunwich Horror, there's a guy who goes to consult the Necronomicon at the Miskatonic University,
which is
another place that shows up in Lovecraft's writing.
And there's a town.
Arkham, Massachusetts.
Isn't that in The Colors Out of Space?
Yep.
Or maybe it's in the Dunwich Horror.
No, I know that it's in the Dunwich Horror, but I think The Color Out of Space mentions Arkham as well.
Yeah.
You know, it says this town outside of Arkham or something like that with the... with the what did it call? The blasted thing I always loved heath. About
the Necronomicon is it was written by the Mad Arab.
Yeah,
the Mad Arab. And so when he says in Randolph Carter, he says, most, I believe, are in Arabic, meaning these books.
Uh-huh.
And the fiend-inspired book, which brought on the end, was written in characters whose like I never saw elsewhere. So there's also this idea of these books may be in Arabic or some odd foreign language, but there's also, you know, whether it's runes or a language, again, from somewhere that you can't even imagine, those are written down and people are using these books.
Right, so. Right.
Very mysterious.
Very mysterious. And I'm trying to find really fast here. Here's one. I hope this is it. Okay, excellent. Okay, one of the reason that we know so much about H.P. Lovecraft, we know more about Lovecraft than we know about Edgar Allan Poe. And the reason is because this guy wrote letters and letters and letters. I mean, thousands of letters. He was constantly writing letters to people. And we have a lot of them. Arkham House Press has published something like 5 volumes of his letters.
Wow.
And they've got a sample of one of the letters online, and I'll be sure and link to it in the show notes. But the reason that I wanted to bring it up is because I found that this was interesting. He's writing Clark Ashton Smith.
Oh.
And this is on November 27th, 1927. Okay, so this is 7 years after the statement of Randolph Carter came out. The last paragraph of this letter says, I've had no chance to produce new material this autumn, but have been classifying notes and synopses in preparation for some monstrous tales later on. In particular, I have drawn up some data on the celebrated and unmentionable Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred.
That's it.
Yes, it seems that this shocking blasphemy was produced by a native of Sana'a, S-A-N-A-A, in Yemen, who flourished about 700 AD and made many mysterious pilgrimages to Babylon's ruins, Memphis's catacombs, and the devil-haunted and untrodden wastes of the great southern deserts of Arabia. The Roba' el-Kalaya, who he claimed to have found records of things other than mankind, and to have learnt the worship of Yog-Sothoth and Cthulhu. The book was a product of Abdul's old age, and on he goes. And, wow. I mean, he wrote so many letters, and, it's astounding.
But I love volumes that he says, you know, I'm filing these away and getting them all sorted out. So he'd been making all kinds of notes as this all occurred to him.
Right, right. And it's kind of neat. You know, the people don't think that when he started writing, I mean, it would take incredible foresight, you know, but when he started writing, for him to think, you know, hey, I'm going to create this giant mythos and it's going to be awesome. You know, it's just that he just kind of kept going to the same place. And he said, you know, wow, wow, I can go further into this and I can go further into this. And then just playing with these ideas and going on and on.
Oh, yeah. Well, and also the fact that he was writing to Clark Ashton Smith, because am I thinking of the right person? Didn't he write stories before and at about the same time?
Well, he had to have, because they were writing letters, yeah.
I mean, Clark Ashton Smith.
Mm-hmm, sure.
I'm thinking of Arthur Machen, I guess, who wrote before Poe, who wrote for H.P. Lovecraft, and who H.P. Lovecraft mentioned. And I think Clark Ashton Smith did also at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned him also maybe in his essay, Supernatural Fiction and Literature, or something like that.
Yeah, and you sent me a link to a story that I did not get read, I'm afraid. It was called The Great God Pan or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I had just listened to... There's a podcast that's now going through the stories very slowly that got mentioned.
Going through the stories that got mentioned in an essay that H.P. Lovecraft wrote.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I had listened to The Great God Pan and said, oh my goodness, there were so many similar sorts of feels that you got from that story.
Yeah.
You know, somebody goes into the woods, they come back, they're crazy. Oh, 9 months later, it's a woman. 9 months later, there's a baby.
Wow.
You know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you're thinking, wow. So they were writing these things about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
Just really interesting that there are
very interesting. And
these kind of stories too.
Yeah. And like I said, Lovecraft died early. You know, he was 46 mm-hmm. or 47 years old. And after he died, there was a group of these guys that he was constantly corresponding with that got together and made sure that they published books of his short stories, because H.P. Lovecraft never saw a book of his own while he was alive. There was never a collection of his stories published in a book form. These were all stories sold to Weird Tales magazine, almost all of them. And so we're talking about guys like Robert Bloch, Fritz Leiber, August Derleth, and Clark Ashton Smith. Yeah, well-known people got together. And I'm not sure what the complete story of the Arkham House publishing house is.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it was created to have an imprint to publish these books under. And I just don't know who owned it or who put up the money or whatever. But yeah, these were all people that Lovecraft corresponded with. He was constantly corresponding. Okay. You know, and Lovecraft, when I was thinking about his life earlier today, it occurred to me, you know, that he's not atypical. He's a very odd guy because, you know, his mom treated him terribly. His dad went insane and died. Mm-hmm. So he got to witness that. And then his mom was very overbearing. She kept him in the house, didn't want him to leave, and would tell neighbors things like he's so incredibly ugly that he doesn't come outside.
I know. She was awful.
Oh, it was awful. Yeah. And one of the interesting things about Lovecraft is through his life, he was definitely an odd fellow, right? But he mm-hmm. seemed to be getting over all of this stuff as time went on, because mm-hmm. he was a recluse until, you know, from, it was something like 1908 to 1917, he was pretty much a recluse and not going outside. And he would write these newsletters that they called back then, they called them amateur journalism. So he'd write a political newsletter. You know, doesn't that sound like a blog today?
Yeah, it does.
You know, this guy could be sitting in his house typing on the internet, you know, doing a blog.
In an attic instead of a basement.
In an attic. And that's how he got to know everybody. You know, it was like he wasn't going outside, but he got to know everybody. And then, and then when his mom died, and his mom died suddenly, I mean, he lived with his mom until she died.
Right.
And when she died, it was a faulty gallbladder operation. So died suddenly. It was like she went in for this operation and she's gone. And it's like, oh, wow, you know. So then shortly after that, he was enticed to go to Boston, which is the first time he'd ever gone anywhere outside mm-hmm. of Providence, which is where he lived. He went there, and then he met somebody who he eventually married. But their marriage was a very odd one, too.
Yes, it was.
Right. But from that point, he started to travel and go outside, and it became, he lived in New York City for a while before he came back mm-hmm. to Providence, and he went to several places.
As some of his stories are set in places around there, as he would travel around, you could see the progress, because he's like, now I know these places. It doesn't have to all be New England settings.
Exactly. And you can see in his writing that he's becoming more and more mature. And mm-hmm. and one of the things that I think is also worth mentioning is he was racist.
Oh,
he was xenophobic. Anybody mm-hmm. who was foreign, he was extremely threatened by. And mm-hmm. he knew that people that he was corresponding with were not of the same mind. Some of them were.
Oh, did he?
Some of them were, but a lot of them were not. So, but I think it's fairly clear that as time went on, he was getting over those kinds of things. And it was almost something that was instilled in him as a kid. And then as he went on, you know, it wasn't an atypical point of view back in 1919 in New England, you know, to be racist.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, for one thing, the time period and mm-hmm. the culture of the time would kind of lend itself to that. And then when you had been shut away from everybody for so long, anybody who was different was going to be threatening.
Yeah. Yeah.
The difference is that since he was a writer, it was coming out in his stories.
Yeah.
Some of the descriptions of the aliens.
Right. A lot of people say that, the Cthulhu is obviously a symbol of this and this and that and this. And I don't know that I buy all of that. You know, I'm sure that there are certain things, there was some things in, I think it was in the Dunwich Horror, where he mentioned, you know, something like, you know, even this race is, you know, something like that. And you read that
that's
today.
That's what I was
like,
thinking of.
I don't think not I the, like that. Yeah.
Yeah. The symbolic stuff. I'm like, I suppose. But you know what? Eventually you can look at everything that way.
Yeah. And you, I, you know, there's no question that you could take, you know, any story that someone writes and try and symbolize it all up.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that there's some of that going on. But I think that, you know, a lot of it's very clear. he writes a sentence, very clear sentence.
You don't have to question it.
I don't think you have
to. It's more the kinds of things like, I was reading a story. In fact, maybe it was called Red Hook.
Yeah, the horror
but it was set
at
in
Red Hook.
Hook.
Yeah.
It was set in New Jersey, and it's very run down, and he's talking about it. And it's, the description is, you're like, oh my. Oh, okay.
And he's talking about foreigners and how they ought not be there and all
this
thing.
Right, and their low, slovenly ways and their, you know, you're like, oh, fine.
Yeah, it's always a remarkable thing, you know, because where did he come from? Where did his family come from? You know, why can't he have thought that way, you know? But he had a very, very odd upbringing, too, you know?
Well, but also, it wasn't that uncommon because I was reading H. Rider Haggard's story, People of the Mist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great adventure story, but even just reading it to myself and knowing that this was written in the early 1900s or late 1800s, actually, I think, and how people thought at the time about, you know, Africa and some of the places these things were set. And still, I would cringe just reading it to myself. And I was like, well, can't read this one on the podcast. Yeah, I would just have to do too much apologizing. Great story. Love it. But And so, if you read stories from that time period, you kind of just have to remember you can't judge them by the way we look at stuff now. That's not the environment that they were in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the way I think about Lovecraft.
Yeah, me too.
On that those issues.
Right. So the statement of Randolph Carter is about this guy, you know, again, it opens up very similar to Hal Dagon and, you know, very similar to a lot of his stories. And in this ancient book, they discovered a hole in the ground next to this ancient stone marker, and they bring a telephone and a whole lot of wire. And
I love that
this guy
the
that
modern
he's,
technology,
yeah, modern technology, and this guy that he's with goes down into the hole carrying the phone, and he talks to the guy on the phone as he's exploring down there, and, you know, he'll say, oh my goodness, you know, I'm seeing this incredible stuff and wow. And then eventually, you know, he just stops talking. He's like, oh,
yeah,
I wonder if he's okay.
But not until he said, run,
yeah,
put the lid on the tomb, run. And and Randolph Carter's saying, well, I couldn't just shut him in with whatever awful was down there. So I kept going, hello, hello. And he's like, no, get away.
Yeah.
There's almost no time. I'm lost. You go.
Right, right.
And that's very atypical because this guy was a real blowhard, it sounds like. Very, very full of his own knowledge. Mm-hmm. And Randolph Carter was just his assistant carrying things.
Yeah. Carter's like, are you sure you're doing this? You know, and all this stuff. And
yeah.
And the story, it's one of my favorite Lovecraft stories because, you know, by the time he's going down the hole, he's created this tension and this incredibly well-drawn picture is, you know, I could see what was going on without any question. And then the guy going down the hole, you know, I'm tense reading it, even though I've already read it. And I don't know. That's why I like him so much. He's just,
and not only that, but it
comes, you know, at the end when you hear another voice through the phone. You don't know what that is, and it's interesting to leave it that way. Again, we're still on that train at the end. Now there's something that's out there,
but
and they've let it loose,
phone.
And it can use a phone, yeah. So not it's intelligent, you know, and evil.
Here's how good how good he is, by the way. I'm still worried about whether Randolph Carter actually put the lid back on the tomb, because he kind of, you know, was insensible at that time. He was found wandering later by people. And I'm just like, did someone put the lid back on the tomb? Because I'm worried.
That's right.
You know, his friend said to do that. And I trust him.
Mm-hmm. No question. So. No question. Oh, that's funny.
Oh, gracious.
All right. So the next story. So the first two stories we picked were very early Lovecraft. And now we're kind of in, you know, his career was fairly short, right?
Right.
So maybe about a 20-year career. So now we're in the middle. Both these other two stories are from the middle of his career. And this one is called The Color Out of Space, published in 1927.
Yes.
Do you want to describe that one?
Oh, this story. Once again, we're given the point of view of an outsider, basically, I guess. Mm-hmm. But he's a surveyor because there's a big valley and it's going to be dammed up and full of a lake soon. So he's surveying everything. And he's walking along the road thinking, why do these inhabitants of the town keep talking about the blasted heath? That's not really something you hear a lot out in Arkham or wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, these country people, they're so ignorant. And then he gets out there and he goes, well, dang, that is what it is. It's a blasted heath. There's nothing else to call it. And all the vegetation is kind of, gray and rotted away and turning to dust. And it's just devastated.
Yeah.
And he's walking along and he notices an old farmhouse and a well, and he's kind of like, I almost saw something out of the color of my eye or corner of my eye. Sorry, color of my eye. I almost saw some colors out of the corner of my eye, and you're just thinking, oh my gosh, I don't like this. And he comes across a local man who's living out in the country, still named Ammy, I guess is his name.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he says, oh, I know all about what happened. The people who lived there, I was really good friends with that guy. And so then he tells him the story of a meteorite that fell. And the meteorite, it had some curious properties. And the scientists kept trying to chip off pieces of it. And they couldn't do experiments very well with it. And in the meantime, it's shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. No one can understand this.
Mm-hmm.
And then things start to go wrong around the farm.
Yeah. Terribly
water. I guess it's not the water, the crops are growing extra big, and that's another characteristic of H.P. Lovecraft. Anything that's influenced usually by these unearthly outer space creatures grow extra big.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crops are extra big, but they're all rotten inside and they taste funny.
Yeah, they look good, and when they tasted them, I wish I had highlighted that. I can't find it at the moment.
How disgusting it was, the
way that he described it. You're just like, oh, I just threw up a little, you know. But it's just like, disgust, you know, leaves such a disgust in your mouth.
Water is like that. I guess that's at the end. But gradually, this blight continues throughout the farm, but they don't have any other way to make a living.
Yeah.
They have to try and bring the crop in. And so then it begins to affect the people.
Mm-hmm.
And you read about the disintegration. Well, I don't want to say disintegration, really, but the decline, I suppose, of first the wife, then one of the kids.
Yeah.
Then one of the kids disappears when he's gone out to the well.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh.
One of the most terrifying images for me is when they go down into this pit thing.
Yeah.
And they find some carcasses, you know, that's basically skeletal, I think is what it said.
At the very end. Yeah.
And then, but they're on this slime stuff and they try to figure out how deep it is. And there's no end. They're putting sticks in there to see if there's a, you know, and there was no end. And somehow that's terrifying.
Well, because, and what it does is it shakes everything up. This is after everything's pretty much gone south and some people have come out. I can't remember why they came out, I guess because somebody died or anyway, it's during the old guy's story. And so they're investigating. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not going to let this bother us. We're going to investigate. And pretty soon it's winding up like the best haunted house story ever. They're all in the house going, don't look outside, don't let it in, you know, blocked up the doors and they can hear the horses screaming. And you're so sorry for the horses because the ones that don't break away give these unearthly howls that they didn't know any animal could make. Mm-hmm. And then it's done for them. And the colors are coming in. And do they make a run for it, Scott? I can't remember now.
I believe that they do. Yeah. And at some point, it leaves. something leaves the Earth.
Because that was really effective.
You know, and they call it the color out of space because they never got a view of this monstrous thing. It was kind of a gaseous color. And he tried to describe a color unlike any other color. And
he says, he's talking about what came out of the well. He says, a riot of luminous amorphousness, that alien and undimensioned rainbow of cryptic poison from the well. Seething, feeling, lapping, reaching, scintillating, straining, and malignly bubbling in its cosmic and unrecognizable chromaticism.
Wow. Yeah.
And yeah, I know. Yeah. So there's your color out of space for you, baby. Right there.
Yeah. And as I understand this, and maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't have a reference, but H.P. Lovecraft, you know how there was a lot of internal discussion. We've talked about it before on this podcast, internal discussion between writers through stories. And this is a science fiction story. There's beakers, there's meteors, there's aliens. And it was a response to the kind of thing that was being written in the science fiction pulp magazines. Not weird tales, but things like Amazing. And then I think that that's where this ended up. I'm pretty sure the color out of space, you know, I better stop there because I'm not absolutely positive, but I'm fairly sure that this one was written in response to some of the stuff that he was reading in other pulp magazines. Oh, how
interesting. I didn't know
so
that.
So this is his science fiction story. Now, you know, and At the Mountains of Madness, this is almost representative. You know, At the Mountains of Madness, he wrote later and is much longer. And At the Mountains of Madness, if you've seen The Thing, you know, I think The Thing is a complete ripoff of At the Mountains of Madness.
Yeah, because that's a scientific team going to the North Pole.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Scientific team. I think it's the South Pole.
But oh, South Pole.
Yeah,
okay.
So they're going in there and they find something in the ice and they accidentally release it.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of what The Thing is about. The Thing is an alien, you know. And it was written by John W. Campbell. Who Goes There is what it was called. So I'd be interested to see. I wonder if there's a story behind that. Behind the story
Well,
kind
you know,
of thing.
I was just looking the other day. Brian Aldiss wrote a book, right, called
Billion Year Spree?
Yeah, yeah. The
I think later,
of science fiction.
Yeah, later updated and called Trillion Year Spree.
That's it. A trillion year spree. And I wonder if that's the kind of thing that he's got in there.
Yeah, very possible. Like. Very possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but, yeah, Campbell would have written that in the 30s, I believe. And, you know, this story, At the Mountains of Madness, would have been early 30s, course, late 20s.
Yeah, of course, there was so much borrowing going on.
Yeah, no question. No question.
From everyone.
And
from
I wouldn't put it by, you know, At the Mountains of Madness, I forget what magazine that appeared in, but it wouldn't surprise, you know, I wonder if Campbell bought that story.
Oh, no,
I'm way too
that's
interested. yeah, let me type that in there.
I was trying to think, and this was in that BBC show where they were saying that Lovecraft had to write to the editors of a magazine to explain to them what his story was about. And then they went, oh, well then we'll buy it. Okay. Now that you've told us, I was thinking maybe it was the Dunwich Horror.
Yeah. Well, look at this. At the Mountains of Madness appeared in Astounding Stories.
Okay.
Which was...
Wasn't that...
Let's see. I thought... let's see.
Wasn't that John Campbell?
I thought it was John Campbell. In 1936. And I'm trying to figure out now...
when The Thing was...
Yeah, when he was in charge of it.
Or...
You know, then that would actually make a lot of sense to me if Campbell, you know, and this is pure conjecture, but if John W. Campbell bought that story and then kind of wrote his own version of it, saying this is how he should have written it, I could see him doing that. Shoot, I'm afraid I'm not going to have an answer today. I'm kind of flying through that looking, but.
Well, we can put it in the show notes.
Okay. Tremaine was promoted to assistant editorial director in 1937. His replacement as editor of Astounding was John W. Campbell Jr. So that occurred in 1937, which was the year?
The year after?
Yeah, the year after. So that was not a Campbell story.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd be interested to find out if, yeah, that'll be kind of fun to look into.
But if he was promoted to editor, he was working on it or read it or knew about it or.
Yeah. Yep.
All that.
Mm-hmm. And that would be something maybe he was like, oh, you don't want to publish that. That doesn't, that's no good at all. And then he wrote his own.
Now let's not put words in John Campbell's mouth.
Okay.
Although I've heard enough stories that I could believe it.
You bet. Yeah.
Which I'll never know the science fiction lore that you do, but I know enough to know that.
Yeah. John W. Campbell had a pretty tight grip on things for a long time.
Yep. Of course, luckily he had good sense of story and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah, I have a book of his letters. They've only published one that I know of, and he wrote a lot too. And those are fascinating to look at because some of my favorites. I haven't read the entire book, but some of my favorites are where he's talking to Frank Herbert about Dune.
Oh,
and he's like, "Yeah, this is pretty good, but you know, you might want to be doing this."
That's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting. And then Frank Herbert wrote Dune. Campbell bought it, published it in the magazine. And then Frank Herbert wrote Dune Messiah, which is an anti-hero book. It's Dune was a hero book and Dune Messiah is anti-hero. Campbell hated it, wouldn't buy it. Ended up in Galaxy magazine or something like that. Somebody bought it, but it wasn't Campbell.
Yeah.
So,
and Dune Messiah is about the same person, right?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Paul
Atreides becomes king of the universe, basically.
Right.
In Dune, it's his whole trip. It's a Messiah thing, right?
I love that book.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a terrific book. And then Dune Messiah is about. As you read Frank Herbert, he said he wanted to write a book about, he was inspired by JFK and he was worried by JFK because JFK was so charismatic and people were blindly following him around. And Frank Herbert was like, you know, this could be really, really dangerous. You know, he's this charismatic leader. And what does he know about leading? We're not asking those questions. We're like
the main question.
Yeah,
to ask.
We're like,
that's,
hey, you know, he's awesome. You know, we just love him because he's him, and how dangerous that is for a country. So, Dune Messiah is about Paul Atreides losing control of what he's ruling, and it's the fall of Paul Atreides.
I've never been that interested in it. I think because it was told from Princess Iris's point of view. Or some of it.
I think when I picked it up and started to read it,
and I was like, "Yeah, I don't want to read something of this style." So I just, I'm very shallow. I just
there are people in the book who do things in his name that he's not asking them to do, and they're terrible things. You know, like armies are ransacking towns and things because they're saying, you know, we're his army, and you know, so he's lost control. His charisma has started this thing in motion that he can't stop.
Yeah, because he doesn't have the actual power necessary or the knowledge necessary.
The power. You know, once things have gotten out of hand and now you're bigger than you really are, you can't control it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting book, I thought.
Wow, and really interesting with that background behind it.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. I still haven't read Children of Dune. That's next. I've got that on my list. It's been on my list for a while.
Sounds like that needs to move to the front of
the list. Yes, it needs to move. But yeah, Dune is a terrific book. Maybe we ought to do Dune sometime.
That first book is terrific.
Yeah.
And I haven't read it for a while though, but I read it several times when I was younger.
Yeah, I really like it.
You know, something that struck me about The Color Out of Space was this scene at the end where all the color is, everything's glowing in the dark by then. And it's like, okay.
Man. And that was spooky too.
Yeah, I know. And eventually it you know, the colors take everything over, and it says, you know, there's like a big wind and gusts from interstellar space are shrieking and howling and lashing the woods into a mad cosmic frenzy. And the boughs of the trees are kind of reaching upwards because these colors are on it. So you can see that they're all trying to go back up to where they need to be. So it's almost like it's opening a portal somehow.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting, that whole description of everything's just rising up and it shoots straight up into the skies, except for that one little bit that couldn't make it out of the well.
Yeah.
Which I can't feel sorry for it because it's horrible, but still, it's that one little remnant is still at the bottom of that well, which is, I guess, what leaves everything so blighted.
Yeah.
And this is probably way too Catholic of me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just going to say it since we're talking about Catholic stuff. I was thinking about these colors and the glowing and how they took everything over and turned it into them, into whatever it was. And it was inimical. Okay, it was hostile, super hostile to anything organic. Uh-huh. It hated it. Let me just say it like that. And it shot up away and left nothing good. And then I was thinking, I can't remember what else I was reading at the same time where I was listening to that reading and thought, that's the exact opposite of the Holy Spirit.
Hmm.
That at Pentecost kind of came down and did the same kind of an earthquake thing. You know, they were speaking in tongues and everybody could understand them and there were healings, there were all these things. And even now at baptism and confirmation, you receive the Holy Spirit and you're empowered with the grace of God. And it changes you, but it doesn't change you in a way that is hostile to you. It changes you in a way that makes you, if you're cooperating with it, more of you. You know, it allows to be more free and to be more of who you were meant to be in the first place. And so the Holy Spirit is almost like the light. I always think of it as this golden light, of course, because that's very classic. But, you know, shooting down and filling us up, but making everything lush and fertile and better. Wow. And happier. Mm-hmm. And more wonderful.
Fascinating. That's terrific thought.
Yeah. And it, yeah. I have nowhere to go with it except that it just made me.
No, I mean, it surely suddenly could have inspired him in a way where he was looking at that and saying, well, maybe this is like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an anti-God thing that he's doing there.
I don't know if it even hit me that way. I just looked at it and the exact opposite is what struck me. And so that's when I was later, I was starting to think, well, this is almost devilish in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's so hostile to anything human and organic and everything else, just of its own nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
So,
Fascinating.
Anyway, that's all I had on that. So
it's fascinating.
It's just like the mirror image.
Uh-huh.
And it still affects everything around there. That was the thing that interested me about the guy at the very beginning. He says, you know, I didn't like it when I came out under the sky void, as Lovecraft called it.
Uh-huh.
He says that two or three times at the beginning, I came out from the trees and the sky made me nervous.
Usually
the dark.
I noticed that too. I noticed that too. I thought that was interesting.
And then at the end, he says, I'm never going to drink from this reservoir because I don't like the way the sunlight changed color around the mouth of that abandoned well I passed. And he still doesn't like to be out under the sky.
Mm-hmm. Right.
More now than ever. But yeah.
Yeah. No question. Yeah. That's good story. Good story again.
Yeah.
Yep. And then that brings us to the last one, the Dunwich Horror. And I really enjoy this one because it kind of encapsulates a lot of the elements of what he does. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the recurring things like Arkham, Massachusetts, the Miskatonic University, and the Necronomicon is in there. And these eldritch gods are in there. And all this. So
The people who worship them.
Yeah, and the people who worship them. So
which I don't get. Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, why? I have no idea.
Explain to me why the old man's going, oh, you'll never meet a great man like his father. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and this is something that I meant to look up, but I didn't. Maybe you know what it is. But in the story, it says, Wilbur Whately was born at 5 a.m. on Sunday, the 2nd of February, 1913. This date was recalled because it was Candlemas.
Oh, yeah, which people in Dunwich, the candles are all blessed at the church.
Okay, which people in Dunwich curiously observe under another name. And he doesn't tell you what it is.
I know, which is bad enough, but it's also a Catholic thing.
Right, right.
So, but it seems to me there's some other, you know, there's always more to it than just blessing the candles. If it's in February, it's probably something to do with, like, I think they used to have a lot of observations of things like Christ's circumcision and all these various little milestones, like say little, but you know, it would have been a big thing to the Jewish people of his day. So
Wilbur Whately, like it says here, Wilbur Whately was born at 5 a.m. on Sunday at this Candlemas. And because the noises in the hills had sounded and all the dogs of the countryside had barked persistently throughout the night before. Less worthy of notice was the fact that the mother was one of the decadent Whately's, somewhat deformed, unattractive albino woman of 35, living with an aged and half-insane father about whom the most frightful tales of wizardry had been whispered in his youth.
That's also very significant to a lot of his stories, is that idea of the decadent branch of people. Like some of his stories, when the denouement is, oh, they've obviously been breeding with these fish people from under the sea kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, there's something not quite right, not quite fully human about them.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly right. So this Wilbur was born, and he is not your average person. He grows incredibly quickly. He's obviously got something going on that other people do not have. He grows really fast. He becomes mature really fast. And people start to see him around. And then at some point, he ends up going to Arkham, Massachusetts, to visit the Miskatonic University. I'm kind of giving the short version here. He goes to Miskatonic University to consult the Necronomicon. And he talks to a professor that's there. And that was kind of an interesting exchange where the professor wasn't too keen on having him look at it.
Because the first part of the book's almost told like a history lesson.
Yeah. In a history, it's like a family history.
Yeah. Which I was listening going, I don't really like this style. And then it's funny because about the point, I guess, when he's consulting the professor, don't things suddenly shift to his point of view?
Things definitely suddenly shift. I mean, the whole story.
There's dialogue.
You get some dialogue, right? And he doesn't have much of that. So you have this section that says, for a decade, the annals of the Whately's sink indistinguishably into the general life of a morbid community used to their queer ways and hardened to their May Eve and All Hallows orgies.
Ooh.
Twice a year, they would light fires on top of Sentinel Hill. And that's about where the story shifts. So it's saying, you know, this kid's been born, he's growing incredibly, and then 10 years pass. And then after that,
also, which I found sinister, they were buying a lot of cattle and their herds weren't really increasing.
Right, exactly.
I was like, what's happening? What?
Yeah, buying a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so Wilbur goes there and you know, it's fascinating. He's got a copy of the Necronomicon, which is incomplete, and he's comparing it to the university's copy. And he says, can I have this? The professor says, no, I don't think so. Yeah, because this is a pretty rare book. Anyway, long story short, Wilbur goes back home, uses whatever he learned from the Necronomicon, and lets something loose. Or does he kind of transform? I'm trying to remember the exactly what happened, because I'm pretty sure it's Wilbur. No, it actually isn't Wilbur, is it? It's like a twin of Wilbur.
Well, that's, talk about giving it away.
Yeah, but, I just gave it away, but
that's okay. Well, yeah, because that was the thing where, what happens is Wilbur dies.
Yeah.
Wilbur's killed, right?
Yes.
The dogs go nuts.
That's right.
And so it's
a result of whatever he learned from the Necronomicon and whatever he did. Right?
Because he was looking for a formula, he said.
Right.
Which
and whatever,
I love
whatever
this.
He learned, he performed.
In fact, here's one thing where Armitage is talking. That's the professor.
Yeah, Armitage is a professor, right.
He says, inbreeding. Armitage muttered half aloud to himself, "Great God, what simpletons. Show them Arthur Machen's Great God Pan, and they'll think it a common Dunwich scandal." And I went, Arthur Machen, Great God Pan?
Yeah.
So he's throwing that in there, too. But yeah, whatever happens it is when the Dunwich horror comes.
Right, right.
And he dies, and all the dogs are going nuts, which, you know, I'm so happy I have dogs. They always are.
Yes, dogs will protect you from whatever Lovecraft's got happening. They'll at least warn you. They don't protect you, but they let you know that it's coming. And my cat will do nothing but sit there and watch me get eaten.
And go, tentacles, can I play with that? Like yarn?
Yeah, I'm kind of hungry now. Can you, are you busy?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the cat's way.
Exactly.
Well, these, the dogs in all of these things usually will try to attack. And I'm just like, oh, good dogs.
Yeah, good dogs, good dogs.
But yeah, what's happening is, but here's what I thought was really interesting was and once again, Professor Rice declares he wholly lost consciousness for an instant. So someone fainted yet again. But I'm sorry, I had to say it.
You bet.
But they're looking at Wilbur. Was that his name?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which, of course, what a name. It says, because it was partly human beyond a doubt, with very manlike hands and head, and the goatish, chinless face had the stamp of the Whatleys upon it. But the torso and lower parts of the body were, I don't even know what this means, teratologically fabulous, so that only generous clothing could have ever enabled it to walk on Earth unchallenged or uneradicated. And so then they're talking about it had the leathery below the waist. Oh, no, wait. Above the waist, it had the leathery, reticulated hide of a crocodile or alligator.
Mm.
The back was piebald with yellow and black and dimly suggested the squawkiest covering of certain snakes. Below the waist, though, was the worst, for here was where all human resemblance left off and sheer fantasy began. The skin was thickly covered with coarse black fur, and from the abdomen, a score of long greenish-gray tentacles with red sucking mouths protruded limply. And it goes on from there.
Tentacles, right.
There's a whole nother long paragraph of description.
And then this thing gets away, you know, and terrorizes the countryside.
Well, that was Wilbur.
Yeah. That was Wilbur?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That was Wilbur. Wilbur's dead. And they go, oh, and someone goes, yeah, I guess that part was more like his father. And you're going, what? So something's terrorizing the countryside, but it's invisible.
It's invisible, yeah. And, right, it's marching around and doing
crazy.
Well, they released something or whatever. But anyway, didn't they get a glimpse of it and it drove somebody insane? Am I confusing my stories?
Because there was a wonderful sequence, for one thing, where they're talking on the phone to the people who are like, well, now there's something coming down the road. Now the fence is going down. Now they're like, get out. They're like, well, now the front door's gone. And the house is squashed, you know. So you're like, okay, but I can't see nothing but big footsteps, you know, so it's invisible.
Right, right.
But then what happens is the professors, there's three professors, Armitage and two other guys, who I had completely forgotten the invisibility thing. I completely forgotten it was squashing stuff. And I'd certainly completely forgotten these three brave professors with like this, I imagine this old time, you know, like mosquito sprayer thing.
Exactly.
Some kind of powder.
Exactly.
They're climbing up this hill.
Yep.
Where the,
we're like, all
the
right,
Mayday,
my body's
Halloween
a weapon.
Things are done.
Yep.
And so the other guys are watching through a telescope, and
that's
how you get the report that they squirt something on it, and that's when they're, oh, I don't think I could stay conscious. Maybe they faint.
Because they saw it.
Yeah,
it was visible for a moment.
Yeah, because then they start trying to describe it, and it's another long set of things about tentacles and octopuses and cyclops and giant things.
You bet.
And they are able to kill it.
Yeah. And they do kill it. And, you know,
I
read this thing about, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I can't remember how they killed it.
Well, see, that's I read it a couple of weeks ago.
Didn't it have something to do with the Necronomicon? Didn't they have, it was like a spell that they were going to do?
Reading a formula, and as the enchanting, because they could hear the chanting, and they could hear the men chanting, and I kept thinking, those three frail little professors are never going to make it. But yeah, they were passing the telescope back and forth and reporting. Yeah, poor Curtis collapsed completely, by the way, before he could say anything. Right. So somebody did faint. I'm glad to say. But, oh yeah. So they're chanting and chanting and chanting, but without warning come deep, cracked, raucous vocal sounds, which will never leave the memory of the stricken group who heard them.
Right.
Not from any human throat were they born, for the organs of man can yield no such acoustic perversions. So they come from this stone altar.
Yeah.
Where the father thing is supposed to come through, because that's what the dying grandfather made Wilbur promise that he'd do, I think, was set the brother free, because it was his twin brother.
It was his twin brother, right.
That was the thing where I went, it was his twin, and I went, oh, altogether.
Yeah, wild, 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 wild. See, I'm just flipping through it here, but...
Things like that brought down beings those Whatleys were so fond of, the beings they were going to let in tangibly to wipe out the human race and drag the earth off to some nameless place for some nameless person or purpose.
Yeah.
And you're just like, why would they do that? But I guess because they're, what was it? Not perverted, but there were some, you know, not quite human themselves.
Yeah, right.
There was a word, started with a D, I can't remember it.
Mm.
From the beginning.
From the beginning?
About what the Whatleys were like. They were from some
that's right.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about and why. Yeah.
But, yep. Yeah, that one's got everything in it.
It does. It does.
And when you're listening, the way he maneuvers it, you know, you're listening to the history part going, oh, okay, fine. But the more details he puts in, you start finding yourself really getting pulled in.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time he changes over to Armitage talking, you're really kind of worried about what Wilbur's going to do with this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he's got this wonderful device of, you know, the every time something gets crushed or people disappear, everybody's throwing their clothes on and going to see what's happening. And you're following with the group of professors and the posse and gathering little bits of information like that phone call. And so you just get caught up in this. With the crowd, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Just running from thing to thing, going, what is it? What is it? I can't wait to see. Because he's got you at this fever pitch of anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he did
a great job. The decadent Whateleys.
Yeah, decadent.
Sorry. Thank you. I could not find that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
But it occurs to me, other than the audio that I've heard, like from Uvula Audio or the Wayne June things, I've never heard these really read out loud, and that actually might be the best way to hear them.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Or to read them. I don't know.
Hmm.
There's something about the rhythm of the words. It's like somebody said once that Poe is really meant to be read out loud. In fact, I think it was Neil Gaiman who said that when he was taking long driving trips, he had these old tapes of various wonderful, famous people reading Poe out loud. And the rhythm, he would drive further than he had to just to hear the ends of stories because of the way the language would roll.
Mm.
And I kind of felt that way about this because that doesn't allow me to do any skimming.
Yeah,
and it pulls me through all those adjectives that he uses and through the way he's building the story so that I was really engaged in these.
Yeah, that's great.
I
feel that way when I'm hearing Wayne June read them.
Oh, well, he's really fantastic.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
Yep, so I got to try Uvula Audio, and Will Duquette is excellent.
Oh, thank you.
Yep.
And SFF Audio has been doing a lot of Lovecraft, and they generally have the story audio at the beginning.
Yeah, and I'll make sure I link to, the statement at Randolph Carter, they actually had Wayne June.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it that one that they had Wayne June
I think
on?
that was the one. I'm pretty sure that they played the Wayne June audio before that, but I'm not sure. They actually had Wayne June on one of them, but I think it was Lovecraft.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
I'm well, I know positive. It was Lovecraft. I can't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
But they've done quite a few.
Yeah, they've done quite a few. We'll try to see if Jesse will make a list of, do a post with a list of his Lovecraft posts.
Come on, Jesse. You like those lists. I know.
And then
you do.
We'll link to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most interesting things about reading Lovecraft now, and this may be part of why I like him a lot, other than the reasons I've said before, uh-huh. is that he's like source material for a lot of writers.
Yes, he is.
We did a book called Declare,
mm-hmm.
and by Tim Powers, and there were Lovecraftian elements in that book.
At one point they're at these tops, the top of these mountains, and if you've read any Lovecraft, you're just, I'm in very familiar territory now.
Exactly. And in the in science fiction, one leaps to mind, Charles Stross' short story called A Colder War, which was published by Infinivox on audio, that was about, I mean, it was a Lovecraft pastiche. I mean, it was 100% Lovecraft. Lovecraft could have written it, but it was modern day.
Said about the laundry. I mean, that's a short story about that series that he's got from The Laundry. I think I might have mentioned it, but
I'm not sure about that. But it had to do with up in the north, in the freezing cold. They found something, you know, very much like a Mountains of Madness, but it's during the Cold War.
And what would a
government do with one of those things if they found it during the Cold War?
Well, because he has a series of novels. I think there are four or five. I can't remember now, but I really enjoy them. I don't really care about his other series as much, mm-hmm. but these are set from a guy who was recruited to work in what's called the Laundry, and it's a super secret CIA type, except it's British, or mm-hmm. so MI5 type organization, and they are there to basically keep out all those awful creatures that Lovecraft posited. And each book is written in kind of a different style, so one is more like a 007 style, and one's a Lynn Dayton style. However you say it. So yeah. They're all kind of like spy styles, because there's, of course, an evil element that's trying to bring them in. So,
I think I'd really like those. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, people who know too much about them about their computers are often kept an eye on by the Laundry, because the whole idea is that computer logic is just these old formulas and these old rituals and the chanting, like they were doing in the Dunwich Horror, are easily translated into math.
Mm.
And since machines like computers use math, people will stumble upon these sometimes themselves.
Oh, how about that?
When that happens, then the Laundry is keeping an eye out for this kind of thing, and they have to be recruited so they can be trained, or they'll put them away somewhere.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So,
I need to check that out.
They're really
that sounds
fun
really
to
great.
Read. I think you'd really like them.
I will check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and so that's why that story may be the first time he was exploring that kind of
maybe
a concept.
Maybe it was. Maybe
I'll have to look for it.
Yeah. It's
he's fun to read. He's easy to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved, I think it was his most recent one, the Fuller Memorandum about that.
Mm.
It was really good.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But you'll see it once you've read a few of these stories, you suddenly notice this stuff everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I really think that he's more influential than Poe. And it's interesting that, you know, in typical books or lists of great short stories and things, Lovecraft isn't always on there. In fact, I can't think of a list he was on. He certainly wasn't something that I was given in high school to read.
Yeah.
I was given Poe, you know, everybody reads Poe in high school, but, you know, I'm not sure what it is like now, but it seems like Lovecraft is something that authors today are going to, you know, and Stephen King, I mean, The Mist, I don't know if you saw the movie or the movie. Gosh, what a terrible ending. Holy crap.
I was told about the movie.
Okay.
And the person told me the ending, because I said, I'm probably not going to watch it. He goes, well, here's the ending. And he told me, and I went, why would they do that?
You know, I was with my son, who was probably 16 or 17 at the time.
Yeah.
Went to the movie theater, saw it, and I just couldn't believe the ending. I could not believe it. So
well,
we drove straight to the bookstore. And I got the book, The Mist, and I said, look at this, Chris. And I got to the end of the thing and read the end, read that last page. And it was, I mean, Stephen King had written a hopeful ending.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know why, whoever did that movie, I can't remember who did it, but why do that? I mean, that
it must have been
it's just
for
like
shock
Stanley
value.
Kubrick or somebody must have done that movie.
Oh. Well, yeah, somebody
I know
without
he
hope.
Didn't. I know he didn't, but it was somebody without hope. So.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to take it back for a second to the Catholic idea, mm-hmm. is that that concept of always having hope even when it seems hopeless is kind of goes hand in hand with the idea of suffering counts for something.
Yeah.
It's not just useless.
Yeah, and I can sure see that.
So that, you know, so that the ending that you're talking about from the movie wouldn't even work.
Yeah.
Because anything that those people went through could be redemptive suffering for them or for somebody else if you had the right mindset. If it was a bunch of Catholics in that movie who understood that. But
I was upset. I was like,
yeah, it sounds like a nihilist.
Yeah,
interpretation.
Just mean. That's what it was. Just mean.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's Lovecraft. What do you have anything else that you just, you know, for those folks out there, you know, I have a book in mind, but do you have any other books that you just love at Halloween?
Oh,
something that just leaps to mind. I'll just say mine while you're thinking, but
yes,
Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book. I know I've mentioned it here before, but what an excellent fun book that is. It won the Newbery Award. It's a YA book, so it's okay for your kids. I remember the first chapter makes you wonder what you're in for because he talks about a very sharp knife and you've got and a toddler kids. Who escapes this house while this guy is doing terrible things just off camera, you know, but your imagination makes it much worse than it is. But after that, once you get past that first chapter, and again, it's nothing, again, I think my imagination makes it worse than his words. But after that first chapter, what you've got is a story of a kid who, just like Mowgli in the Jungle Book, is raised by the jungle. This kid named Nobody Owens is raised by ghosts in a graveyard. And
it's a great book.
It's a terrific book. Really terrific. So highly recommended.
Yes.
Yeah, what did we do last year at Halloween? Why isn't that leaping to mind? Oh, it was Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh, yeah, because I was looking, kind of looking at my bookshelves thinking, because I thought of two books, and mm-hmm. I just thought, well, is there something I'm missing? And there probably is, but, and I saw a set of Bradbury stories, and I was like, oh,
never
we already
go
read.
Through October without reading something from Bradbury.
Yeah, I know.
A short story or anything.
Stories or something.
The October Country is a collection.
That's a good one.
Just terrific.
I need to reread those.
Yeah.
But I did come up with one. You said Neil Gaiman, and I was like, you know, I like The Graveyard Book, mm-hmm. but really, in my opinion, the best book he wrote is the first book of his I read, and it may be his first book, which is Neverwhere.
Never. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now, The Graveyard Book is for kids.
Right.
And adults, because anybody can enjoy it. But mm-hmm. Neverwhere is for reals.
Oh, wow.
It's for grown-ups. And after you read Neverwhere, you understand why you should be afraid when he has a book with a kid and a knife, because he will do that thing sometimes.
He will.
You can't trust him.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing book, especially for Halloween. And then the other one, which is really different, is The Historian. Have you read that?
I haven't read that, but I've seen it.
Costola
or somebody like that?
Yeah, and it's it's a... Well, how do you tell? It's told from two or three different timelines, but it's this girl, essentially, whose father... Is it her father disappeared or he died? But she's always traveled a lot with her father, and somehow she got interested in vampire stories And then she suddenly gets this letter, I believe. I say I need to reread it, but it's a really big book. She gets this letter that kind of makes her suddenly go, what? And so she starts investigating. It's like she leaves her desk at the library to go look for something, and she comes back and hears this letter on her book. And it kind of leads her off to this very long hunt, but it's basically, it's a vampire story.
Oh, cool.
People love it or hate it one way or the other because it is kind of long and meandering. But it's got, I think all the meandering has a point in this case. Maybe I just liked reading it. I don't know. It's beautifully descriptive too. Well, and great. She travels around all kinds of places in Europe and everywhere.
But, wow, another book for my list. But yeah, great.
I know. It's boy, I might have to pull that one out again. If I wasn't rereading East of Eden for my book club.
Cool. I have some neat Neverwhere news.
Oh, yes?
At least I think it's neat.
Yeah?
On Twitter a few weeks ago, have you heard of Dirk Maggs?
No.
He's probably the best audio dramatist there is.
Oh.
He did Hitchhiker's Guide, the last three.
Oh,
he's okay. done American Werewolf in London, an audio version, which is just unbelievable.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. He does shows for the BBC or that end up playing on BBC. But anyway, I saw him on Twitter mention that they're doing Neverwhere as an audio drama.
Oh my God.
And this is professional, great stuff. I guarantee it's going to be fun.
Oh.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'm going to look around. Well, there's no telling what our library has. Maybe they'll have.
Yeah, Dirk Maggs, he's got, let's see, some of the more popular ones. He did a Superman. I can't remember what it's called, but he did a Superman and he did a Batman for the BBC.
Okay.
And they're both terrific, too. I mean, they're just incredible. But An American Werewolf in London is one that I'd recommend to anybody if they can find it. It's not too much different from the movie.
Never saw it.
Yeah, but it's really good. And that's a crazy movie. That movie kind of lives in history because of the makeup. You know, it's kind of a horror comedy.
And that's what I've heard, but I just never saw it.
Yeah, and it's about a guy who's in England in the moors, actually two guys, they're hiking through the moors and they get attacked by a werewolf. And, they both survive that, but one of them got bit. And of course, you know, what happens is he's
badness.
Now the werewolf and he starts to kill people. Sort of, you know, it's not, he can't control it. He turns into a werewolf and he's killing people. Anyway, his friend, who is now dead, visits him to tell him that he's a werewolf. And he keeps visiting him throughout the movie. And it's played by Griffin Dunn. And every time you see the guy, he's in a worse shape. He's you know, just decomposing throughout the
falling
whole movie.
Apart, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing is the transition from person to werewolf was kind of groundbreaking too. And I forget the fella's name who did the makeup. But he was the monster guy at that time. He was the guy, you know, did the hunger and all this stuff. But that's why that movie's famous. And it is a comedy. So yeah. It's fun to watch.
Would I like it?
I think I think that you would, you know, knowing that you liked Shaun of the Dead.
This
is not a horrifying movie by any means. It's just, it's kind of funny.
Yeah. And, then maybe I'll rent it.
Yeah. Give it a shot.
Well, I was going to say for a movie completely different from American Werewolf in London is Let the Right One In.
Oh, you've mentioned that before, and I so need to watch that.
Sometime we'll watch it, but if you want to see, it's not funny. It's pure evil, but it's probably got the best depiction of evil I've ever seen. Pure evil.
Yeah, I need to look at that.
Yeah.
So, cool.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, we've gone on and on and on.
Wow, we have. Well, now we've got a scary movie coming up for us to watch for Halloween, though, right?
We do, yep. Yep, the movie we're going to watch in 2 weeks is The Sixth Sense by M. Night Shyamalan. So we'll get to talk about him a little bit.
I will try not to be too terrified after I see it again.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, and I highly recommend seeing that movie without hearing anything about it, if you can.
Yep.
If it's too late, I'm sorry.
Don't read anything.
Yeah, read anything. Don't go read a review. Just go watch it.
Yeah. Be like my husband going, what was that about?
Mm-hmm.
Ghosts. Just watch it.
You bet.
And then after that?
And after that, I believe, is when...
Are we going to have our...
Is that when we're doing the... I can't Heroines? Remember what order we're doing it. Heroines is okay.
I don't remember.
That's what I... Yeah, let me just look at the schedule here.
At some point, we have a Heroines
talk. Yeah, so on November 8th, we'll publish our Heroines talk with guests Heather Ordover and Rose Davis and Joseph Suzanka.
I guess that's how you say it.
Did I say it right? I hope I did. Yep. Anyway, we're going to talk about, obviously, Heroines, past and present. This is just... It's a discussion that came out of
Jane Eyre,
and we were talking about Hunger Games at the end of that Jane Eyre podcast, and then Brave came out, and it just became a discussion that just kept going on, so we thought we'd record it.
And Rose had gotten really passionate when I was talking to her about it and written an essay. It seemed like an essay. She wrote me an email about the standard old school heroine versus the new modern heroine, and we actually posted that.
Cool.
On the blog at some point as part of the show notes, because maybe it's part of Jane Eyre because we were talking about it.
Yeah, I think that's where we put it. Yeah.
So that's what we're going to probably launch from is her question.
Fantastic. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Really looking forward to that. Bleak House by Charles Dickens.
Trying to give Scott as much time to read Bleak House as possible.
No problem. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to start that last night, but I ended up... we didn't get home till about 11 o'clock last night, so.
That's too late.
That is too late to start Charles Dickens.
Yes,
so
it is.
So I think I'll start him tonight.
Oh, excellent. With excellent. The fog. Lots of fog.
Okay.
Yep. Okay.
Excellent. Well, thanks again.
Thanks for sticking with us, everybody. Oh,
you bet. That's right, folks. It's probably 1 a.m. wherever you are.
I know. We have been talking for a while.
I love it. Well, we'll stop talking now.
It was Lovecraft. We had to.
You bet. So. We could just keep going on him too.
Yes, we could.
If you're in the Salt Lake City area, I highly recommend going to Conduit, and hopefully they continue that tradition. I know there's a lot of changes down there on that particular convention. Probably changes for the better, but. Anyway, hopefully that panel stays running.
You really got to have some kind of Lovecraft thing going on.
Yeah.
It's fun. Seems like.
Terrific fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well thanks, everybody.
Have a good couple of weeks, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.